Absolutely. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I am Ira Flatow. A little bit later in the hour, we're going to be talking about a new global warming study and whether physics can help explain the stock market. But first, Michael Gillen joins us now to talk about the question about has that first human being really been cloned and his own role in trying to answer it. I'm sure you've seen him in the news this week. He's been on just about all the major talk shows. He's a scientist and journalist who asked to review the claim by CloneAid, the company that recently announced the birth of the first human clone. And earlier in the week, he suspended his review, saying he now believes that the clone baby might be a hoax. We'll ask him. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Let me formally introduce Michael Gillen, scientist and journalist, science editor, former science editor at ABC News. He's on the phone today from his home outside Boston. Welcome back to the program.
Hi, Ira. Hi. It's great to be with you again.
Are you sitting there by the phone waiting for the phone to ring?
You mean from the CloneAid people?
Yeah, from the CloneAid people.
You know, I believe it or not, even though this story has been making headlines, I do have other things to do, but figuratively speaking, I know what you're asking, Ira. Yeah, it would be nice to get that phone call, wouldn't it, to have them come through on the promise they made to us initially.
Mm-hmm.
But not yet.
Mm-hmm. And so you still have some hope that there really might be a clone baby out there.
You know, I don't hope anything, and you know me. You've known me for years, Ira. I'm a scientist and a hard-nosed one at that. I mean, physicists, they don't come any harder. And, you know, to me, seeing is believing. I want DNA samples, not excuses. I mean, that's the bottom line.
But you did put yourself in a precarious position by becoming part of the story as a journalist, did you not? I mean, you, as someone who has a vested interest in the outcome of the story, as someone who is an independent journalist who might sell the story to the networks or somebody, isn't that a conflict of interest?
Ira, let me correct a couple of things. First of all, I don't have a vested interest in the story per se. I mean, what's the bigger headline, that this is a hoax or that this is for real? So mm-hmm. I don't have a vested interest in the outcome. I just wanted to clarify that first. And second of all, because I know people are used to associating me with ABC News because, my goodness, I've been there for 14 years as their science editor, and 14 good years, I might say. I chose to become a freelancer because I wanted to broaden out my interests and explore other things. But as a freelance journalist, as you know, what you do basically is if you enterprise a good story, you offer it to the networks, and, you know, you don't work for free, Ira, and neither do I.
Mm-hmm.
So I just want to lay that to rest. But
could I offer them a story that doesn't have the pot of gold at the end of the rainbow? In other words, if I offered them a story about the non-birth of a clone baby or birth of a non-clone baby, that's not as good as the birth of a clone baby.
Yeah, I follow you, but let me clarify yet one other thing, and that is that I think you're referring to my interest in doing a documentary. Is that right, Ira?
Yeah.
Yeah. Listen, I've made no secret out of my interest in doing a documentary. It's everybody who knows me understands that this is a story that I have been working on quite seriously for nearly 6 years. I've done reports on Good Morning America, typically, you know, 5 minutes long. I've done 10-minute stories on 2020. But a story of this complexity with so many social and religious and ethical implications really requires a much longer format. And so I've made no secret of the fact that I would love to be able to document this. Now, you have to understand, and this is very important that you and your listeners understand this, because this has been entirely misunderstood. My interest is in a human cloning documentary, not just on CloneAid. I have, over the nearly 6 years that I have been investigating this story, gotten close to all the major players, not just CloneAid, but Dr. Panos Savos, who's the fertility doctor in Lexington, Severina Antonori from Rome, Richard Seed, who works out of Chicago. There's even a chap who calls himself the creator, whose location I cannot divulge. And so, you know, my fate doesn't rise and fall on what CloneAid does and doesn't do, and I need to make that very, very clear.
Mm-hmm. But by volunteering to be the one who will form the committee to judge the veracity of the claim.
Right.
And having an interest in pursuing the documentary, that does not, you know, doesn't that say, in the normal way that science is done, we would have had an independent bunch of researchers come in that weren't even part of me, and I would report on that group doing the research instead of me saying, hey, I'm here, I'll do it.
Yeah, no, but Ira, here again, please let me clarify a widespread misunderstanding. And I say this is an honest misunderstanding. I'm not suggesting that anybody has any sinister reasons for misunderstanding. But what you just said is exactly what I proposed to do from the first place. If you listen carefully to what I said at the press conference, I said that what I am proposing to do is not to put the claim to the test myself. First of all, I'm not qualified. I mean, I'm a physicist, but I don't do DNA testing for a living. And you're quite right. I think it would be reasonable for a reasonable person to say, you know, Gillen's been following this story for the better part of 6 years, and even though he's a trained journalist and can maintain his impartiality, he's interested in doing a documentary. Maybe there might be even some subconscious bias that he doesn't intend to creep in. And I took care of that because by saying I was going to convene an independent group of first-rate, unbiased experts, people who have absolutely no dog in this fight, and they were going to be doing the collecting of the DNA samples and doing the analysis. I was merely going to be an observer and a reporter.
But you'd be selecting the members of this group, though.
Yes, yes. And so I can anticipate your next question. Ira, I know you too well, and you're a reasonable person. And by the way, these are all very reasonable questions you're asking.
Well, I hope
so. Questions I would have asked if I were, you know, you were on the other foot.
Yeah.
But, you know, I also am thinking ahead, and I'm no fool, and I have a reputation to protect. I've worked very long and hard, as you know. I'm a serious-minded man. So what I did to protect against that possible objection is to say, when I put this team of independent experts together, of course we're going to need to operate in secret because we are constrained by the Clonate people not to give away the identity of the alleged mother and the alleged clone, right? But what I said at the press conference and what I continue to say is I will reveal to you all at the end. Not only will I report the results that this team has come up with, but you will get to see the team yourself. You'll get to interrogate them. The entire process will be transparent, and you will be able to decide for yourselves if I have done a good job or not. And there's not anything more than I can do. So there is absolutely no room for conflict of interest, no room for me to influence the results whatsoever.
Mm-hmm. Can
you understand that, then the criticisms really evaporate.
Can you tell us, if not the names of the people, the professions they would be in that team?
I'd be happy to, Ira. It's not something that I've been talking about, but I respect your show, and it's the reason I came on here. You're like me, a very serious journalist. Let me tell you what the plan was, and as I say, if one day we are given access, you'll see the team for yourself, and even if we aren't at some point when I get the feeling we're never going to get access, I'm going to reveal the team.
Mm-hmm.
One way or another, you guys are going to get to meet the team and judge for yourselves. But here was the plan. I sweated the details. After the press conference on the 27th of December, I flew home to Massachusetts and I started working the phones. As a journalist who's been covering the science beat for a long time, I know geneticists, cell biologists, molecular biologists, forensics experts, DNA testers, and I basically was asking a very simple question. Tell me who you think should carry out this test. And when I would contact these various labs, I would ask them the following questions. Do you have anything in your history? Have you ever been hauled into court, for example? One of your results been challenged in any way, shape, or form? Is there a scandal in your background that could possibly embarrass this team? Because, of course, by then everybody had heard the news and they knew I was trying to put together this team. And so the net result, and that was a good, from Friday, it wasn't until about midday New Year's Eve, which would have been a Tuesday, did I have the team in place. During that time, I was vetting everything, all the right questions.
Who would actually be taking the samples?
Okay, I'm coming to that. So now, once I had the team in place, here was the protocol, Ira. There would be one designated person, and this is a woman who's had an enormous amount of experience, many years of experience, taking what are called buccal swab samples. This is where they basically take a Q-tip-like device and they swab the inside of a person's mouth. They scrape, the whole idea is to scrape off what are called buccal cells. These are the kinds of cells we have inside our mouths. And this is standard procedure. And now, mind you, this independent expert would accompany me to where the alleged mother and the alleged clone would be. I would never touch the swabs. The swabs would come in the possession of the independent expert. I would merely be standing and being a witness to this. The expert would swab the mother, swab the baby. Each swab would be put inside of a little capsule, a sterile capsule, then into an envelope. Then evidence tape would be put across the envelope. The woman would sign her signature. She would take possession of all the samples and leave. Leave without me. Again, I'm just strict as I can. I want to make sure, you know, even Randy the magician couldn't.
Well, you're anticipating my question. My question is, why is there no magician on this team? If you talk to Randy, I know you have, he will always say, you know, scientists are fooled by magicians all the time. You know, they can palm things, do all kinds of stuff, but they always forget about putting someone who's an expert of sleight of hand along these studies so we can watch them.
And in that regard, I actually agree with Randy. When I put the challenge to Clonaid, it was enough of a chore to get them to agree to let me and an independent expert come. Believe me, Ira, if I had a magician, I would. But keep in mind, and you raise a good point here, we sweated out who that designated independent expert would be who would accompany me. And it's a person who's very senior, lots of experience, and who knows many ways in which, people kind of try to defraud these things. So she's very keen on the various tricks. In any case, those samples would be in her custody the entire time, from the location back to the lab. There would only be one handoff, and that handoff would be from her to her counterpart in the second lab, because I wanted some redundancy. Half the samples would be handed to the second person, and we would be videotaping that handoff to make certain everything is kosher. Then I said to the labs, what are the most elegant, most exhaustive analysis we can do on those samples? And we were going to do both nuclear and mitochondrial. And more than that, Ira, I was told by everyone I spoke to that CODIS-13, which is the term used to apply to the most, what is called the gold standard in the DNA business, testing business. It's the one used by the FBI and so forth. I wanted to do even more than just CODIS-13. CODIS-13 is where you look at a DNA in 13 key places. I wanted to look more than that. So, and then beyond nuclear, I wanted to look at mitochondrial. So we did everything we possibly could to make certain that the chain of custody on the collecting and the transporting of the samples would be totally above board, totally kosher, and that the analysis would be as exhaustive as it possibly could. We were just never granted access at the end, Ira.
Do you have any feeling that you might eventually get granted access?
You know, it's a good point. When I issued my statement, because I thought, you know, I was patient enough, and I was patient enough, I didn't want to bail out because I didn't want to be accused of, you know, taking on a very important responsibility and then, you know, bailing out prematurely. My statement came out on Monday, and then Clonaid came out with a statement shortly afterwards saying that the parents were postponing the decision. And I looked at the phrasing very carefully and then spoke to the Clonaid people. I said, I want to make certain I understand what you people are saying. When you say they're postponing their decision to allow our experts access, do you mean they're closing the door entirely, or are they leaving the door open? And I was told they're leaving the door open. And so I went back to my team members and I said, do you want me to just pull the plug on this thing, or do you want to just also remain a little bit open? And to a person, they said, Mike, don't pull the plug. We want to do this. This is important. And so I said, fine. But I will say to you today, Ira, that I will not be strung along, and neither will the team. And we're prepared to mobilize again, but it will take more than just another promise. It will take virtual guaranteed access. We proceeded in good faith on the agreement that was given to us, and we had all the proper intent.
Mm-hmm. All right. Michael, I've got to run, but I want to thank you for taking time to talk with us.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Ira. Thank you so much for allowing me the opportunity to clarify a few honest misunderstandings.
Well, have a great weekend. Dr. Michael Gillen, a science and journalist. He was science editor at ABC News. He joined us by phone from his home outside of Boston. He's still waiting for the phone to ring. We're going to wait for your phones to start ringing us. So stay with us. We'll be right back, switching gears after this break. I'm Ira Flatto, and this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatto. A bit later in the hour, we're going to talk about how physics can help explain what's happening in the stock market. Maybe if no one, you know, you had the analyst, the fits. We're going to have a physicist. Maybe he can explain a lot better. No one really knows what's going on. But first, new evidence about the effects of global warming. Because if climate change is for real, right, then we should be seeing some evidence of it in the natural world. Previous studies have started to document some of these changes, from melting glaciers to early spring migrations to the movement of species northward as temperatures there increase. Now, two studies just out in the journal Nature are providing what some experts are saying is the best evidence yet of this fingerprint of global warming. And my next guest is the lead author on one of those papers. Terry Root is a senior fellow in the Center for Environmental Science and Policy at Stanford University's Institute for International Studies in Stanford, California. And she joins me today by phone from her office. Welcome to the program, Dr. Root.
Thank you for having me.
So you're all excited about these studies.
Very much so.
Tell us why. Tell us why your studies are, you know, bring to light things that other studies have not.
Well, what these studies do, both of the studies did, was to look at a whole bunch of studies that had been done on a lot of different types of animals and plants and all over the world. So it wasn't just let's look at the study here or let's look at a study there or let's look at a species here or there. It was actually taking about 150 studies all together and saying, what do we find from those 150 studies?
Mm-hmm. Our number is 1-800-989-8255 if you'd like to talk with Dr. Root about her studies. Give us a little thumbnail scratch of what you found.
Well, what we were looking at was how many species were actually changing over time. And of those species that were changing, we found that 81% of them were changing in the direction that you would expect with global warming. And some of those changes are they were actually moving their ranges north in the northern hemisphere and south in the southern hemisphere, and they were also moving ranges up in elevation on mountains. Another finding was that they were arriving back earlier. Some of the birds that were migrating back in spring, they're coming back earlier now than they were, say, 10 or 20, 30 years ago.
How much earlier would that be?
Well, in one study that was done on the tree swallows, that is a species that occurs pretty much across North America, in northern U.S. and southern Canada, they looked at about 3,500 nests and found that over a 24-year period, the tree swallow was nesting about 8 days earlier per decade. So it's quite a strong signal.
Okay. I interrupted you. You're going through a list of other things that have changed.
Of other things.
Yeah.
The other things are that trees and flowers are blooming earlier. The other aspect of changes in timing is that trees are losing their leaves later in the fall, and birds are migrating later in the fall also. So there's what's happening is we're getting a longer growing season, it seems. Then other changes are things like there's been a change in the genetic variability of some species. So some species are losing some of their genetic material. Let's see, and there's been shifts in the densities of species. So in some regions where the species didn't used to be very abundant, now they are quite abundant.
Wow. Let's go to the phones, 1-800-989-8255. Randy in Wichita. Hi, Randy.
Hello. How are you today?
Hi there.
I've lived in the Midwest, Oklahoma and Kansas, for 40 years, and I've noticed that the population of armadillos seems to be moving north into southern Missouri and northern Arkansas, even up into Kansas now, a lot more than I've ever seen in the past. And I'm wondering if there's other species like armadillos that would be considered maybe West Texas, southern Oklahoma type animals moving and migrating north.
Well, I'm not sure that I can say that there are certain ones that are from West Texas. I'm sorry, I can't pull those out of my brain right now. But there certainly are an awful lot of species that are shifting up north. A lot of the warblers are shifting north. Baltimore Oriole, for instance, is also moving north. And
well, the fact that Randy's seeing these armadillos that he may have never seen before in his neighborhood or his backyard.
That's right.
That would be evidence, wouldn't it?
That's right. It certainly would be.
Randy, are you seeing new animals that are...
Well, The armadillos are really the thing that I notice the most, yeah, because they seem to be the most roadkill. You know,
right. Well, that's one way of noticing them.
Yeah, you notice. Yeah. You don't see them out there in nature as often. But I know, even out in the Flint Hills, I go out there quite a bit, and a lot of times on the highway, you'll see a dead armadillo. Where 20 years ago, I mean, you never saw those in Kansas.
Right.
That's right.
Well, that's, well, you're part of the experiment now.
Well, good. I'm glad I could contribute.
Thanks, Randy.
Thank you.
1-800-989-8255. And I guess I jokingly call it an experiment, but it would be nature's experiment, would it not? Because we're redistributing nature, so to speak.
That's exactly right. And that's the concern. The experiment that we're doing is actually on our own planet. And if we don't like the outcome, then what are we going to do? So,
Were you able to show any effects? Were you able to look at any effects that the redistribution is having?
Yeah, there have been several studies that were looking at the effects. One of them is looking at a bird that migrates in Europe, and it is not coming back any earlier, but the caterpillars that it feeds on, they are actually hatching earlier. So that means that the bird is having to nest in a much shorter period of time. And the concern is that they are going to be having to nest in such a short period of time, they're not going to be able to do it, and that could really decrease the number of individual birds that there are.
Did the birds eat the caterpillars? And
yes.
Could they running now out of control?
There's a possibility that may be happening. I'm not sure it was in this case, but that certainly is a possibility, a very big possibility.
Your study found the most extreme changes in higher latitudes and high altitudes. What's the significance of that finding?
Well, we know that the globe has warmed by about 1 degree Fahrenheit in the last 100 years, and we know also that the higher latitudes should be warming more, and that's what we found, because what happens is the sun is beating down and is warming up the planet, and that melts the snow and the ice. And snow and ice actually reflects sunlight. And if it melts, then it absorbs the earth, then absorbs the energy, and that makes the earth warmer, which makes the ice melt faster, which makes the earth warmer. So we get in this little loop. And so the higher latitudes where there's more snow and ice are warming faster.
Yeah, we've had other scientists come on and talk about how disease spread is changing, and one of the altitude relevant diseases was malaria.
Right.
People are seeing mosquitoes they had never seen before.
That's right. That's exactly true. And again, that's some evidence that global warming is occurring.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the phones. Let's go to Delray Beach, Florida. Carrie, hi. Welcome to Science Friday.
Oh, thank you, Ira. Thanks for taking my call. I love your show. I'm down here in South Florida, and there are a lot of people, obviously, down here that have come from up north, and I wanted to ask your guests about if any of their study focused on bodies of water. So many people that I know from up north, when they go back after not having been back for several years, say that bodies of water that they used to ice skate on don't freeze anymore. And I was wondering if they found any evidence of this, and how that affects the fish and other species that live in those lakes.
Well, I didn't look specifically at ice melt, but there's a colleague of mine at Wisconsin, John Magnuson, that did a very elegant study looking at how the lakes were melting much earlier. And unfortunately, in the database that we looked at, we just didn't have any information about the fish in those regions.
We did a program a while last winter because in upstate New York, around Buffalo, in the Buffalo area, we have the Great Lakes, and you have lots of lakes in the state of New York.
Mm-hmm.
We had drawing out of my memory is going to be rough. Let me see if I remember. But the relevant thing was he said that for the first time in anybody's memory, none of the lakes in western New York froze.
Yes,
I hear this from people, many people, over and over.
And there was algae stuff. They had convened a whole bunch of scientists to figure out what's going to crawl out of these, not physically, you know, what's going to be growing in these lakes. Because they never froze over,
that
might be a problem, a health problem.
Yep,
right.
So I heard the same story that you heard, Carrie.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've heard it from so many people, and you know, it's just upsetting that I think certain political parties describe global warming as a myth. But
Well, global warming really is a fact.
The contentious
part is whether we're doing it and do we need to pay to stop, you know, polluting so much so that we're not escalating the warming.
Carrie, have a nice weekend.
Thank you. Thanks. Have a great weekend. You too. Bye.
Thanks for calling. 1-800-989-8255. Do you think that we're going to be hearing of other new studies? Are there others in the works that are going to be documenting more and different changes?
Oh, there's going to be a lot more, I believe, because what we looked at was a whole bunch of studies, and there are now a lot of studies that are just looking at particular areas and seeing how things are shifting. The other aspect is that we need a lot of data to be able to do those types of studies, and now that people are realizing that if they have long-term data, they should be looking at it in this manner, and I do think we'll get a lot more studies.
Is the rate of change of shift a surprise, or is it what you would have expected?
I actually was really very surprised. We've only had the 1 degree of warming in 100 years, and I honestly didn't think that there was going to be a very strong signal. And biology, species are very, very noisy. You don't know if they're coming or going sometimes. And so I didn't think that we'd be able to get a signal out of the noise, and yet it was a very, very strong signal that came through. And that's what really frightens me, is because the Intergovernmental Panel for Climate Change has predicted that by the year 2100, the Earth could warm by 2 to 10 degrees. And if we've had this much change occurring with just 1 degree average global temperature warming, what's going to happen when we warm by 10 degrees?
That's the experiment we're all in, isn't it?
That's right, and let's try and stop that experiment. In my opinion, that's what we need to do.
Let's go to Kratz in Manchester. Kratz, you there?
Yes, I am.
Hi, go ahead.
Well, one question and a comment. Am I to understand that a longer growing season is somehow a bad thing?
Dr. Terry?
No.
Dr. Root, I'm sorry.
No.
So there are some pluses from global warming.
Of course. There are pluses.
And I have a comment. My comment is, 20,000 years ago, we came out of an ice age. Who's to say this isn't anything more than just another natural change?
Well, I am not qualified to really say what's going on as far as a natural change goes or not. What I did was I actually looked at the fact that we have had warming over the last 100 years, and I wanted to see what was going on with the plants and animals. But the scientists do show that the increase in CO2 is very much going in partner with the increase in the temperatures.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thanks for calling. 1-800-989-8255 is our number. A quick reminder, I'm Ira Flatow, and this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Are you going to be releasing any other data, or are you pretty much these studies summing up what you found?
Oh, there's a lot more things that we can be doing with these data, and what we want to do is in the first IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel for Climate Change, that came out in 1996, they showed that there was a discernible impact of humans on climate. And then in the most recent Intergovernmental Panel report, the statement was there's a discernible impact of climate on animals and plants. And what I would like to then do is try and find out if indeed we can say that there is a discernible impact of humans on plants and animals. So that's going to be the next project that we're working on.
Mm-hmm. See if I can get a quick phone call in to Mike in Lantana. Hi, Mike.
Yes, hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Quickly.
I would just like to really see how we looked and see if there is a trend somewhere that we might be missing. Are we on a 500-year cycle that we're on the upside now as far as temperature goes, that we could turn the corner? And secondly, have we identified, other than just saying generically it's humans, have you pinpointed the source of what this warming might be, if it is something in the modern-day society? Is it fossil fuels? Is it, you know, burning forest fires or what?
Well, again, that's not my real expertise, but yes, we have forest burning, we have car pollution, we have power plant pollution, that type of thing. Anything that's putting fossil fuel emissions.
Is it any single factor, though, that you've been able to point to?
To any single factor? No, yes. We can't say that there's a single factor. Biology is much too complex to say that there's just one. We can even say that our agriculture is adding to the greenhouse gases. About 15% of our greenhouse gases are coming from agriculture.
Is that methane?
It is methane, right.
Mm-hmm. So at this point, it's not really smart to say what the proposal is to try and fix this yet. We can't really target something yet, right?
Sure, we can target something. We can target the burning of forests, the burning of fossil fuels, and agriculture.
All at once.
I don't know what you mean by
that. Well, I guess it's tough to set a political agenda that broad. I think it's going to be tough unless we can focus on a couple of things to really give us a purpose to it. Right now, we're casting a pretty broad net to say these things need to be put in control.
But there are things like having hybrid cars that really makes a big difference. Mm. Instead of having SUVs that get, say, 10 or 12 miles to the gallon, let's have hybrid SUVs that should be able to get 30 miles to 40 miles to the gallon. That will make a big dent in all of this. And changing how power plants, coal-burning power plants, we need to be worrying a bit about those. There are various things that can be done if they need to be done.
You think people will get the message?
Oh, I think that the two studies that just came out in Nature are making people sit up and take note and say, yes, we do realize that the warming of the globe is, in fact, affecting species, and that could be affecting ecosystems in a way that we could be destroying ecosystem services, things like our pollinators and the like. We really need to be concerned about how the natural communities are going to be affected by this warming.
Dr. Root, I want to thank you for taking time to join us this afternoon.
Thank you.
Yeah, you're welcome. Dr. Terry Root is a senior fellow in the Center for Environmental Science and Policy at Stanford University's Institute for International Studies. We're going to take a short break and switch gears again, and we're going to talk about econophysics. It's not a new car. It's an economics and physics combined. So if you think that those market prognosticators have had a tough time predicting and understanding the stock market, we're unleashing some physicists on it, and they've already got some results. So stay with us. We'll be right back. Talk about it. I'm Ira Flatow, and this is Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. You're listening to Talk of the Nation Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. This hour, we're going to end up with econophysics. Econophysics, applying physics principles to the financial markets. And if you follow the stock market at all, and who is not, especially in these last few years, then you're aware of just how wrong Wall Street analysts have been in their predictions. Can physicists do a better job? Well, they couldn't do a worse job, could they? Joining me now is a physicist, the father of econophysics, who says that the buying and selling of stocks conform to well-known everyday physical principles that govern things like how water turns to steam. He's got a paper out in this week's issue of the journal Nature. Gene Stanley is the director of the Center for Polymer Studies in the Department of Physics at Boston University in Massachusetts. He joins us by phone. Welcome back to the program, Dr. Stanley.
It's good to be back, Iron. It's good to hear your voice again.
Well, thank you. That's very kind of you. Last time you were on here, you were talking about the properties of water. Now, I'm waiting to hear how a physicist who studies the properties of water can apply that to the stock market.
That's a very good question. Probably everybody else is waiting for the same answer. Water, as you well know, can exist in more than one phase. That means the same water molecule can be recognized either as the familiar liquid water that we might swim in the bathtub, or as solid water that we might get just by putting it in the freezer for a few minutes. Water can be in two different phases. So also we found that the stock market can be in two different phases, a phase in which buying predominates and a phase in which selling predominates. The remarkable thing is not that it can be in two phases. Everyone who hears the radio knows that the market can be either going up or down, but the remarkable thing is that we find that there's a tuning parameter, just like the temperature in your freezer, such that when you cool water below this magic value of the tuning parameter, 32 degrees Fahrenheit in the case of water. The water changes its phase from liquid to solid. So also, remarkably, when the tuning parameter is changed for the stock problem, the stock changes from being in the buying phase to being in the selling phase.
Wow. What parameter is that? So we can all make some money here.
It's a parameter that's a little bit abstract to define, just as temperature is abstract. After all, temperature is not a simple thing to explain. It's easy to say how you measure the temperature with a thermometer. But what exactly is temperature? And what exactly is temperature is almost an entire course of physics. Similarly here, to know exactly what is the temperature variable of the market is not simple, but it's a statistical parameter having to do with the fluctuations in demand for the stock.
Mm-hmm. And does it accurately reflect buying and selling on the stock market?
It seems to. That's why we have a paper in Nature. We were able to actually analyze 100 million trades. And when I say we, I don't mean me alone. I mean Vasiliki Pleroux, postdoctoral fellow here at Boston University, and Paramaswaran Gopikrishnan.
Mm-hmm. And what is the end point? I mean, what is the ultimate, the holy grail of a physicist studying economics and this field of econophysics?
I guess the holy grail is to understand on a deeper level stock price fluctuations, which, as you correctly said at the beginning, basically nobody understands. We know they fluctuate. We fill a quarter of every newspaper with financial news, and yet there is no clear understanding of exactly what's causing those fluctuations.
But people buy and sell stocks for all different kinds of reasons. Are you saying it doesn't really matter if we take a close-up look of why they're doing this? If we stand back and just look at the trades, we can understand it?
Roughly, that's the case, and that's because people are not crazy. People are all buying and selling stocks the same way they're playing a game of chess, namely following very well-defined rules with a very well-defined goal.
Mm-hmm. And so you plug those rules into a mathematical equation, or how do you sift through this?
That would be nice if we could if we could find the actual rules that govern human behavior, then maybe we could try to do that. It's not quite that sophisticated. We actually just look at the behavior of these individuals by analyzing literally every trade. 100 million trades have to be analyzed. That's every trade of every stock over a long period of time. And when one does that, one has enough statistics that statistical features of this behavior can emerge.
Hmm. Now, a few years ago, we had a show where we talked about physicists who were, because they couldn't find jobs in their own industry, actually were being gobbled up by Wall Street.
That's still true to some degree. In fact, I just checked this morning at 7 a.m. this morning with a trader in Wall Street who I know to ask what fraction of new hires today are coming from physics. And what he said is that typically 50% are coming from physics or engineering. Engineering being
50% of Wall Street traders?
New hires.
New hires are coming from physics and engineering.
Correct.
Wow. You mean they could actually make some money now that these people have never made any money in their lifetime being a physicist or an engineer?
Exactly. Now, you might wonder why is that the case, because there's certainly plenty of economists coming out of college that could just as happy going down to Wall Street. And it's probably because engineers, physicists are educated to solve problems, and both of their educations are, in fact, quite quantitative in nature, and so also Wall Street is a very problem-oriented business.
Mm-hmm. You sell, you buy, you make money.
Exactly.
It's very simple that way, and if you know how it works, that's more to your liking and to your boss's liking, I guess.
Exactly.
So where do you go from here? Do you have other phase changes, or is it different when you measure phase changes from ice to liquid, from liquid to gas like steam? Would the same rules apply for the stock market?
Yeah, the same rules is a little bit strong, but precisely analogous rules obtained. And so analogous that if one makes graphs of the corresponding phenomena and put them side by side, you cannot see a difference until you look at the fine details or read the axis or something of that sort, or read the units. One might be in units of dollars and the other might be in units of pressure or temperature, but the phenomena are remarkably parallel.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to the phones. We have some people with some questions. 1-800-989-8255. Jamie in Medford. Hi, Jamie.
Hello.
Hi there. You have to turn your radio down.
This is Ned in Minneapolis.
Oh, well, go ahead.
I just have a question. What is the significance of zero on the Fahrenheit scale?
Nothing special. Of course, it's not... on the Fahrenheit scale, it's even less special. As you know, on the centigrade scale, it marks where water freezes. On the Fahrenheit scale, it means absolutely nothing. It just happens to be the conversion from Fahrenheit to centigrade.
Okay. Thanks for calling 1-800-989-8255. It is something very almost magical at that phase change when the when water changes from one from let's say from liquid to solid.
Something is indeed very magical, namely that the water molecules, even though they have no brains, suddenly line up and form a perfect crystalline lattice. This is rather analogous to what might happen in the military, where the bugle sounds and the soldiers get out of bed and have to line up. But in the case of the military, even if the soldier is groggy, still has a brain, and soldier lines up by looking at the neighbors and adjusting his or her distance from the neighbors to form a perfect straight line. The water molecules do that spontaneously.
But doesn't that mean that they must be communicating with each other somehow?
And they are indeed. That's the key word. They're communicating. In fact, you put communication as the key word that explains this whole phenomenon. The water molecules communicate with each other because water molecules interact through forces of nature with other water molecules. And so also the people that trade in stock markets interact with each other. They interact also through forces. Those forces are actually the forces of buying and selling stocks. So, for example, if everybody starts to unload a given stock, and I won't mention any names, but we all know that there are stocks that seem to be going straight down, these traders are interacting one with the other because they're all seeming to signal to each other that this stock is not worth what it's selling it right now, we're going to get rid of it.
Hmm. So they're just acting like a bunch of blind water molecules. So.
Exactly.
Forget
and in fact, the stock market is remarkably like a system of water molecules because it's comprised by many, 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 many units called traders, all interacting one with the other, just like a glass of water is comprised of many units, water molecules, each interacting one with the other.
Huh. Wow, we're talking about the stock market not behaving as a bunch of bulls and bears, but of a little... cute teddy bear heads, like the H2O molecules shaped.
And even things like the dot-com bubble, where all the traders sort of thought that the certain categories of stocks were going up and up and up and up, so they all believe they're going up and up, and of course the stock price followed that. Just like water molecules, who all believe it, who are oriented to do a particular thing, and everybody follows.
And the greatest coincidence of all, they called it a bubble. We're talking this about the market this hour and Talk of the Nation Science Friday from NPR News. Now, I would imagine, here you have this paper in Nature, and you have figured it out, that the... I figure by now that, you know, there are some of these physicists who are on Wall Street, as you say. They're looking at this paper and they're running into their big bosses who have those giant glass booths up there. Wait, this guy has figured it out. Let's go hire him, you know. Let's go figure out how we can use practical use of this knowledge. Is there a way of doing that?
Indeed there is. Indeed there is. Because there is a control parameter, the analog of the temperature, that you can measure, it becomes possible to display in real time the temperature of each and every stock. Just as we measure temperature in degrees on a thermometer, you can measure temperature in some units for the stock market. And by comparing what the temperature of a given stock is with the magical value, say 32 Fahrenheit in the case of water freezing into ice, we can learn whether that stock is heading toward a phase transition or is not heading toward phase transition. So it has some predictive value.
So you can predict whether it's going up or down?
Over a short term, yes. Not over a long term.
But that's what traders love, that short term.
Traders love a short term, exactly.
Wow. So, I mean, if you're so smart, why ain't you rich?
Well, it was just published yesterday. And we had to get it published first.
You've been down to the Mercedes dealer already, have you? So, but you do think that there's a real practical benefit and that the stock market will be very interested in it. Do you license this knowledge, or is it free, or what do you do with it?
We'll talk about that off the air.
Well, I think you've got the Holy Grail right wrapped up there. If that's that simple, that people can go on their computers and then put these parameters in and watch the colors change?
Exactly right. In fact, that's exactly how we do it. We color code the temperature of the market.
Wow. We do need to talk. So there is real money to be made here with this technology. People always ask us when we do a science story and basic research, where's the money? You know, what practical advances are going to come out of this? And you say that people will be able to time the market.
I think so, or at least know when the market is severely out of equilibrium compared to when it's in equilibrium. And it's important to know when the stock price is out of equilibrium to avoid risk. You don't want to invest a significant fraction of your resources in something that's severely out of equilibrium.
Well, so where do you go from here? How can you top this?
Well, we'd like to design probably work with appropriate firm to design a piece of software that could be on the desks of traders that would indicate the degree to which each and every stock is out of equilibrium and display that in real time.
Well, let me ask you
the analog of what Bloomberg does.
Right. One last question. If you are acting to change it by putting these desktops to work, are you changing the parameters? Are you doing the quantum thing by influencing the experiment itself?
Of course. That's the inevitable thing in all of stock market theory, that as soon as everybody starts doing the same thing, then the effect might wash itself out.
Right. But you're willing to take that chance,
Of course.
Well, thank you. Thank you, Dr. Stanley, and good luck to you. And don't forget your friends, okay?
You're wonderful. It's great to talk with you again.
Thank you. Gene Stanley is director of the Center for Polymer Studies in the Department of Physics at Boston University. I don't think he's going to be doing water research for a whole lot longer if this thing pans out. Earlier we spoke with Michael Gillen, scientist, journalist, and former science editor at ABC News, Terry Root, senior fellow in the Center for Environmental Science and Policy at Stanford's Institute for International Studies, and they all took time out to join us today. Kevin Wade is our technical director. Our audio engineer here in New York is Matt Galick, and Greg Smith composed our theme music, and we had help today from NPR librarians Kim Oleski and Alphonse Vinn. And if you have comments or questions, you can send us the old classic mail way. Here's our address, Talk of the Nation, Science Friday, 1221 6th Avenue, 36th floor, New York, New York, 10020, or surf over to our website at sciencefriday.com, where we have links to all the topics. You can get the link to Gene Stanley's paper, and, you know, who knows where you'll go from there. Also, we have archived versions of all our programming, and we'll have Science Friday's Kids Connection links up there, where you can get curricula for teachers and schools and get free lessons for your classes. Have a great weekend. We'll see you next week. I'm Ira Flatto in New York.